by a guaranteed income tied to a broad definition of work. These people deserve support as well, and programs like Social Security Disability Insurance provide a critical safety net to support them. My uncle suffered from degenerating discs in his spine in his 40s, the result of decades of pulling cables in a physically demanding workplace. He'd been injured as a child when a tractor ran over him on the family farm, and the workplace injuries compounded the original damage, rendering him disabled for life. Without Social Security disability payments, he never would have been able to support himself or my aunt as he has in the decades since. This is what the safety net is for, to help those who can't work. For everyone else who is working in traditional or untraditional jobs, but still can't make ends meet, a guaranteed income is the most efficient way to ensure that they have stability and a chance to find work that's fulfilling and matches their skills. People want to work. Let's make sure it pays for them to do so. Untethered idealism. I arrived at O'Hare International Airport in February 2007, carrying a backpack stuffed with a laptop and a half dozen books, and dragging an oversized rollerboard suitcase behind me. I had come to Chicago in the midst of one of its worst winters in memory to work for Barack Obama's presidential campaign. My now husband and I had packed up all our possessions in Palo Alto and put them in storage purgatory until we found a new apartment. I hopped on the Blue Line and headed straight for Obama's temporary campaign offices on the 17th floor of a skyscraper in the Loop. Facebook's growing popularity, it was up to almost 18 million users, mattered little to the operatives who were setting up shop in Chicago. Eventually, the campaign manager, David Plouf, greeted me, thanked me for being there, and promptly turned his attention back to whatever it was he had been working on. My new boss, Joe Rosbars, wasn't in the office that day, but he had warned me to quash any talk of Obama as a Facebook candidate. It's going to take an extra effort from you to make clear that you're taking a leave from Facebook to work as an organizer here, and more importantly, that this campaign and its energy are not about Facebook at all, he wrote in an email before I arrived. I found my way to the sole digital person in the office. John Jones was roughly my age and already looked a little haggard and unshaven, even though the campaign had just begun. He and I immediately clicked. He was from Scranton, Pennsylvania, the son of working-class parents who'd done everything in their power to make it possible for him to go to Tufts. Like me, he joined the campaign for the most idealistic of reasons. He was inspired by Barack Obama's story and pragmatic idealism. While the rest of the political world thought we were crazy for backing an African-American freshman senator with the middle name Hussein, we thought he was a change candidate who had a real shot at upending the Democratic primary and maybe even winning the White House. All the staffers who took risks to join that campaign in the early days believed that the unexpected could become real. Those first couple weeks in Chicago were a blur. I found an apartment, started hiring a team, and got to work alongside John on a variety of tasks, cutting videos of rallies, setting up landing pages where people could RSVP to future events, editing mass emails for clarity and voice, and inevitably, curating the senator's Facebook and MySpace pages. One day bled into the next, each busier and more frantic than the last. As our digital team grew, we managed to build a social network of nearly a million members, a platform for supporters to organize groups, host grassroots events, and set their own fundraising goals. I didn't find the technical work of building and managing the network to be nearly as much of a challenge as the human dimension of organizing people. I had to provide activists with enough guidance to help them understand what the campaign needed from them, but not so much that they felt like we were narrowly instructing them on what to think and do. Even more challenging, we had to convince the campaign's senior management to let go of the typical top-down command and control structure, in which headquarters dictates the message and micromanages field operations, and instead embrace a decentralized approach that enabled supporters to self-organize digitally. It seems small in retrospect, but the idea of allowing any supporter, no matter how passionate or unhinged, to write anything they liked on a blog on a campaign website, or to organize events, even if they had no training, was unprecedented. The more freedom we gave supporters, coupled with guidance on what the campaign needed, the stronger the network grew. We were initially the crazy tech guys in the corner, but as the number of dollars donated and volunteers recruited through the platform grew, it was clear we were onto something. Over time, we earned more autonomy, and I was able to recruit a team of nearly a dozen people focused exclusively on helping volunteers organize through the campaign's social network. Before we hit send on our victory email and text messages on election night, reporters and academics were already writing articles and reports about how we did it. A lot of them paid attention to the idiosyncrasies of the technology we had developed, but our victory didn't happen because of any flashy features. Most of that was off the shelf and pretty straightforward. It happened because we were able to convince the people running a traditionally hierarchical institution to work with a different kind of grassroots digital structure. Activists and volunteers could feel the difference, and they were invigorated by the power we placed in their hands. Facebook and the Obama campaign, the first two career experiences of my life, both taught me a clear lesson: to aim high and expect the unexpected. Change could happen nearly overnight with the right team and values. Those experiences gave me faith in my ability to buck tradition and to update institutions for a new digital era. When I decided a couple years later to do something similarly unlikely, find a new business model for traditional print media, a lot of people, including myself, thought that it just might be possible. One major success could be a fluke, but two was indicative of some kind of gift, people told me. When rumors began circulating that I was looking to buy the New Republic magazine, a 100-year-old institution of the intellectual left, the Huffington Post made it their big banner story for a day, with the headline, "Savior of the Republic?" That headline was so ridiculous, and my blind ambition so irrationally bold, that any cool-headed outsider could have seen how the story would end. What went wrong at the New Republic has a direct bearing on my work today. It is the driving reason why I favor a more modest, guaranteed income over the universal basic income, or UBI, idea that has become increasingly popular over the past 2 years. I learned how counterproductive, unbridled idealism can be if it lacks practical grounding in the here and now. A few months before I decided to buy the magazine, I went to the basement of the New York Public Library to comb through old issues. The only way I could see and read the earliest ones was to request physical reels from the librarian and fire up a 1970s vintage microfiche machine that I could hardly believe still functioned. I spun through the issues, reel after reel, year after year, over the course of 2 or 3 days. I would roll forward and stop at a random moment and then read through all of the articles on the page. It was a rapid education in the changing sensibilities of the magazine and how much it had driven ideas in liberal politics over the course of the 20th century. I had read The New Republic off and on, mostly online, since college, but I did not have a deep appreciation for the historical moment that it was born into in 1914, or for the values of its founding editors. It had been acerbic and contrarian in its recent past, publishing shameful articles like Charles Murray's The Bell Curve and cheerleading George W. Bush's decision to invade Iraq. But for most of its history, I came to understand, it was more in line with values I shared. Confidently liberal and market-oriented, it pressed the need for a strong central government to guarantee the rights and freedoms that the progressive era, from which it had emerged, had fought for. For me, the New Republic was more an institution of American intellectual life than a physical print magazine. It addressed both the political questions of the day and the concerns of literature, philosophy, and culture. What if we could bring the power of its journalism to new, bigger audiences, both in print and on the screens people carried everywhere? We could invest in both print and digital in tandem, without sacrificing one for the other. In the late fall of 2011, I reached out to the owners, a collection of Wall Street investors led by Bill Ackman and Larry Graffstein, who had recently put the magazine on the market. They were surprised that someone with a largely digital background would be interested in a magazine with a circulation of less than 40,000, losing millions of dollars a year. Although I didn't know it at the time, I was the only potential bidder with any real interest. I officially purchased the magazine in March 2012 and headed down to Washington to speak with its staff. Franklin Foer, who had edited the New Republic for a number of years earlier, but was now an editor at large, a mostly symbolic title on the masthead, showed up at that first meeting and sat in the back of the room. I ran into him in the hallway afterward, and we connected immediately. Over the next few months, Frank and I met several times to discuss his previous tenure at the New Republic and our shared belief in the power of narrative journalism to shape the dialogue of the country. I liked that he had years of experience already in the editor role, but I could see that he might bring a fresh creative energy to the work. The D.C.-born son of an antitrust lawyer, Frank was naturally suspicious of the concentration of power in the hands of elites, yet he also called many powerful people friends. His knowledge and experience were wide-ranging, and he exuded a winning charm. I made him an offer, and he began his second stint as editor early that summer. Our first order of business was to invest. The magazine had been on a shoestring budget for years, and we believed the lack of investment was the primary thing holding it back. We offered eye-popping sums to bring on new, talented journalists and to retain the best we had. We created a deep bench of senior editors who were some of the most talented journalists in Washington. We tried to appeal to a broader audience by publishing cover stories on Chris Christie's shady backroom deals and the epidemic of unregulated daycare centers alongside reviews of televisions, girls, and critiques of Ai Weiwei's quote-unquote terrible art. Frank and I wanted to bring new life to the digital and print pages of the publication. We envisioned a magazine and a website that were at once classy and vibrant, highbrow and accessible. In redesigning the print edition, we tried to meld the look and feel of old literary journals, like the Partisan Review from the 1950s, with a splashy contemporary style of New York Magazine. To accomplish this, we hired the New Republic's first full-time art director, an award-winning designer from Newsweek, and a team of print designers who were qualified to work at institutions several times our size. We invested in engineering and website development alongside our traditional direct mail program. These investments took the New Republic's annual losses from around $2 million a year up to $6 million a year, nearly overnight. Everyone on the outside assumed I intended to transform the New Republic into a personal megaphone, or at the very least to use it to advance my own political agenda. But over 4 years, I wrote only one piece for the website on the rise of big data and a short note reflecting on Jeff Bezos's purchase of the Washington Post. The journalists and academics who wrote for us were some of the smartest, most sophisticated minds in media. And whatever I happened to think about the Iraqi surge or Mitt Romney's tax policies felt superficial in comparison. Close friends marveled at how much I talked about the business side of things, and how little I had to say about what Frank was planning to put on the cover. Instead, I became obsessed with how to turn the numbers in our financial statements from red to black. I had no interest in making a profit from the New Republic, but I did want to make it resilient and sustainable. I believed a break-even business would be a testament to the strength of the publication and an indicator of the value of our journalism. This became a personal challenge for me, a kind of golden fleece that I woke up each morning in pursuit of. Making the business work was about something much bigger than the numbers on the P&L. It was about attaining an idealistic, nearly impossible goal, just like we had at Facebook and in the Obama campaign. I wanted to be the one who figured out the model that took aging jewels of print journalism and set them on a surer path in a digital world. I worked at a frenzied pace, learning the nitty-gritty of sales and business management. I traveled to Chicago San Francisco, Washington, and other cities to sell junior ad buyers on our small circulation, scholarly political magazine. A year in, I found myself in a nondescript building on the outskirts of Detroit. Across from me, a 22-year-old ad buyer at a media agency chewed gum while she told us she had never heard of The New Yorker, let alone The New Republic. She flipped through our magazine rapidly, as if she were looking for the photographs of Jennifer Aniston that she'd find in Us Weekly. The idea that I could ever convince her to buy a page in The New Republic was absurd. But my belief that I could do the impossible made me grit my teeth and push my way through. I didn't leave that meeting feeling deflated. I left angry and more determined than ever to create a world where our star would rise so convincingly that even she would have to say yes the next time I called on her. 2.5 years went by. The writing that filled our pages was beautiful and at times impactful. Our web traffic picked up lightly, and even our print subscriptions rose by a bit. Our editorial staff told Frank and me that they felt happy and satisfied with our direction. Meanwhile, I was becoming more desperate. We had signed up a small set of new advertisers, but they paid much less than anyone had predicted. I had bet that the New Republic's prestige and elite audience would command a higher premium. But after years of trying, I learned that few advertisers were willing to pay to be in a small, somewhat partisan magazine, regardless of the quality of its iPad app, journalism, or design. We were losing just as much money as before because our business endeavors weren't showing a trace of traction. I lost sleep over the design of our subscription page and the marginal effectiveness of a direct mail campaign to gain more subscribers. I spent hours in meetings trying to optimize our pages for Google search results, missing the forest for the trees. We had tried our hand at events, apparel, and video, with some success, but it was clear none of these was going to right the ship. The fundamental math of the business just didn't work. The market of subscribers and advertisers was too small to bridge the huge financial chasm that we had dug for ourselves with our early investments. I was writing checks for $500,000 every month to cover our losses, and each one felt like a private confession that I did not have the financial and management skills that I thought I had years earlier. I needed help. The only option I hadn't tried was bringing in executive leadership and investing that person with the authority to run the company day to day. The owner of The Atlantic, David Bradley, had lost tens of millions of dollars for years, until he brought in a seasoned media executive. Within a couple of years, The Atlantic's new CEO brought the company close to break-even, buoyed by a strong events program and a heavy emphasis on increasing digital traffic by writing pithy, timely updates for a broader audience to accompany The Atlantic's long-form journalism. It seemed clear, at least to me, that our pristine and cultured website would have to begin courting mass appeal, while at the same time continuing the highbrow analysis the New Republic was synonymous with. In the late summer of 2014, I retained a recruiting firm to begin a search for a CEO. I interviewed dozens of candidates, and Frank spent time with the final three. I chose Guy Vidra, a 40-something executive at Yahoo who had turned around businesses of our size. Guy's vision was clear. A new, firmer emphasis on traffic metrics, a slimmer editorial staff, more talk of content partnerships, and more experimentation with video. The editorial team had little enthusiasm for his approach. They felt like it was a zero-sum game. An emphasis on digital traffic would come at the expense of quality long-form. I hoped that we'd be able to reconcile differences through a collective commitment to making a popular and sustainable New Republic. But unfortunately, that was not to be the case. Guy and Frank clashed continually over the fall, and Guy recommended that we bring in new editorial leadership. I backed his decision, even though I had meaningful reservations. If I was going to hold Guy accountable for the success of the business, I had to empower him to work with a leadership team he trusted. Guy began quietly interviewing candidates for a new editor, and word got back to Frank. Frank resigned in an impromptu speech to the newsroom, and then hosted a gathering for all the Washington staff at his home that evening. The following morning, a dozen senior staffers resigned en masse, and most of the freelance contributing editors asked to have their names removed from the masthead as well. We were left with 9 editorial staffers, a fraction of the powerhouse roster that had showed up for work just the day before. The public narrative quickly became a story of principled journalists standing up to the corrosive forces of Silicon Valley. The decision the editorial staff had made to walk out on the institution that they claimed to care so much about made little sense to me. In retrospect, I can understand how bringing in a digital media executive felt like a betrayal of what I had been consistently saying for years. I mistakenly presumed that they would know I harbored no secret desire to turn the New Republic into the next BuzzFeed. Instead, many of the editors accused me of harboring motivations that were insidious and malevolent. One former senior editor, Julia Yaffe, made a tour of media outlets to claim that I was downright contemptuous and hostile to the staff. I felt the editors unfairly painted me as a destructive force and a dumb princeling, King Joffrey in the flesh, even though they knew that was not who I was. In hindsight, my decision to hold on to the dream of a break-even New Republic was a mistake. I should have accepted that the future model for institutions like the New Republic is likely to be the same as the one from its past, to rely on generous benefactors to cover moderate losses year to year. The New Republic had been bought and sold a dozen times in its 100-year history, but it was really a cause dressed up as a company. It was a nonprofit that always had and always would serve a small, cultivated audience. We might sweep a few million people into our net in any given month online, but the number of dedicated readers who cared would never be more than 100,000. The sustainable business solution I sought was achievable through largesse and through largesse alone. Washington closed ranks, and the country club that I had effectively joined when I bought the magazine firmly and decisively expelled me. Dinner invitations were rescinded. Friends took to Twitter to publicly renounce their relationships with me. A year later, a person I had never met before greeted me politely at a holiday party at the home of the ambassador to the United Nations. He asked me how I was, and then raised his voice in a scream. Shame! Shame on you for what you did to those people! Half of the people in the room turned their heads to look. He and others like him saw me as the crusader from Silicon Valley, intent on destroying the civic traditions of the Fourth Estate. I had fired a beloved magazine editor in a time of deep anxiety about the future of journalism, and in doing so, had touched a nerve that ran deeper than I could have ever imagined. After the editorial staff left, I spent another year with a new team trying to reinvigorate the company. Despite their valiant efforts, we saw little progress. Eventually, I learned what everyone else had known the whole time. The New Republic would never break even. Unless I had a political agenda to promote, or an axe to grind, and a belief that absorbing millions in losses each year was the best way to do it, there was no future in my ownership. I decided to sell, and a few months later, 4 years almost to the day that I bought it, I walked out of the New Republic's office for the last time. Looking back, there is no question I should have made space for a more measured idealism. The grand plans I came to the magazine with ironically caused me to go too far, too fast, undermining the institution I wanted to shore up and strengthen. Had I spent the $25 million I invested over those 4 years differently, it would have been enough to underwrite more modest ambitions for the institution for a decade or more. In my work today, I purposefully choose more modest means to accomplish otherwise idealistic and ambitious goals. As with the New Republic and the Obama campaign, I was initially drawn to the idea of a guaranteed income because of the big picture ideals. I love the grandiosity of the idea, a world with no poverty, where everyone has a solid financial foundation to follow their dreams. I love that it put the reins of responsibility in the hands of recipients, respecting their dignity, to make their own decisions about where they wanted to live and what they wanted to spend their money on. Research showed that people on a guaranteed income would make better decisions as a result of living at least one step back from the threshold of financial catastrophe. The decentralized, market-driven nature of the benefit would create little new bureaucracy, making it one of the most efficient anti-poverty interventions out there. Martin Luther King Jr.'s writing on the guaranteed income made a particularly deep impression on me. And over time, I returned to his words again and again, almost as if they were scripture. I scoured collections of his sermons and speeches to trace the evolution of his thinking, and found some of the most inspiring words on the topic ever written. "The dignity of the individual," he wrote in his final book, "will flourish when the decisions concerning his life are in his own hands, when he has the assurance that his income is stable and certain, and when he knows that he has the means to seek self-improvement." King put the emphasis on dignity. Other activists and thinkers on the left and right have made the case that without financial security, no one can be truly free. Belgian philosopher Philippe van Parijs has been one of the most visible and ardent advocates for the idea that we cannot imagine a society with true freedom unless all its members have the ability to invest in themselves and make their own autonomous decisions. Friedrich Hayek and Milton Friedman made a similar case. Many of these 20th century thinkers followed in the tradition of writers like Thomas Paine and Thomas More. For centuries, philosophers have argued that only a guaranteed income can grant every individual the freedom that civilization is meant to provide. I knew from my own extreme example that liberation from economic scarcity dramatically expands a person's freedom and enables them to figure out what they want and who they want to be. That first $100,000 windfall bonus I made at age 22 from Facebook effectively gave me a guaranteed income of $5,000 a year for life, assuming a 5% annual rate of return that many investors plan on. That would never have been enough to cover all my expenses, but being able to count on that much income enabled me to feel like I had a little more security. The further you get from subsistence, the easier it is to ask fundamental questions like, what do I want and how do I get it? What are my values and what will I use this money to invest in? A guaranteed income would acknowledge and empower the agency that exists inside every human being, the ability to create his or her own future. In the early days of my work on the issue, I found the purity of the ideals behind a guaranteed income intoxicating and wildly exciting. Later on, I would learn more about the large body of evidence that undergirds the practical case for the effectiveness of cash transfers. But at the start, the boldness and idealism of an income floor for all was what drove me. But I also knew to be wary of untethered idealism. As I began exploring the feasibility of a guaranteed income, I kept thinking about what I had learned from the New Republic. Just because an idea is bold does not mean that the means to achieve it need to be. A prosaic and incremental approach can be a more effective way to put poetic ideals into practice. I found a collaborator with a similar disposition in Natalie Foster, an organizer and activist with a deep understanding of the changing nature of work. We had met socially years before, and she and I had both worked on President Obama's digital team at different times. We reconnected in January of 2016. I immediately loved her style. Direct, honest, and optimistic, she carried copies of a book on the basic income by Peter Barnes called With Liberty and Dividends for All in her backpack and handed them out to anyone curious about the idea. Natalie was already beginning work to explore whether it might be feasible to start a guaranteed income at a city level, like in San Francisco. Later that spring, I also met Dorian Warren, an academic and activist interested in exploring how a guaranteed income could contribute to the movement for racial justice. That year, in the midst of exploring the idea in policy papers, he wrote a call for a guaranteed income into the platform of the Movement for Black Lives. In May, Natalie, Dorian, and I traveled to Switzerland to better understand the dynamics at play in its nationwide referendum on the idea of a basic income. The initiative failed, but the vote sparked a Europe-wide debate on the idea that continues today. The three of us shared a passion for building a world in which everyone has basic financial security. We also shared a fundamental caution. We wanted to better understand the issues and stakeholders involved before making any sweeping statements or big investments. We chose not to start a big campaign or even a new nonprofit, but instead organized a network of leaders into an initiative called the Economic Security Project to foster a deeper conversation around how a basic income might work. Over the past 2 years, we've convened leading thinkers across the country to talk about the guaranteed income in a range of settings, from big conferences to small dinners. Our team has joined community meetings and convened conversations in homeless shelters. We've raised money from a broad group of donors and invested millions of dollars in researchers, organizers, and artists to explore the idea of how a guaranteed income might work in practice, with the hope of inspiring more people to get involved in the work. Importantly for all three of us, we did not start with a big proclamation for UBI. Many people in our network found the initial language on our website tepid and too nuanced. We believe people need financial security, and cash might be the most effective and efficient way to provide it was in big, bold letters up top. The words universal basic income were buried further down the page, not because of a lack of passion for the ideals behind it, but because we purposefully wanted to go slow and create as much common ground as possible rather than setting unreasonably thin, ambitious goals too early. We also knew from personal experience that the idea of a guaranteed income was not that clear. Despite its simplicity, most of the people I talked to who were not economists or philosophers would knit their eyebrows in confusion when I attempted to explain it. Each time I told someone, an old acquaintance, a taxi driver, the person next to me on a flight, what I was working on, confusion reigned. Who gets money for nothing? Is not an exchange for something? How much money will people get and how often? And who's paying for this? That one often had the immediate follow-up. Hopefully not me. Most people would walk away curious at best, suspicious at worst. In search of a more practical, less highfalutin way of talking about the idea, we turned our attention to the one place in America that already has a guaranteed income, albeit a small one. The state of Alaska. Each year, every Alaskan gets about $1,400, or $120 a month, paid out of the Alaska Permanent Fund. The father of the fund was a man who governed in prose, not poetry. Jay Hammond, the Republican governor of Alaska from 1974 to 1982, had in his lifetime been a World War II fighter pilot, backcountry guide, and commercial fisherman. In the mid-1970s, during the heady days of the oil rush, Hammond found himself at the helm of a state flush with cash. He decided to propose a novel idea he had come up with years before when he was mayor of Bristol Bay Borough, a region of fishing villages in southwest Alaska with a tiny population. Hammond had noticed that the out-of-state companies that extracted millions of dollars of profit from commercial fishing were investing little to no money in the poor village that their workers lived in. He proposed levying a 3% tax on fish and distributing the proceeds as a dividend to local residents. That plan was defeated, but just a few years later, he was significantly more successful in applying the same principle to a much more valuable natural resource, oil. The Alaska Permanent Fund, conceived by Hammond and approved by a 2-to-1 margin in a 1976 referendum, deposits a quarter of the annual royalties from the production of oil and gas into a government-run savings account. Over the past 40 years, the fund has grown significantly. It is now worth $60 billion. Each year, 2.5% of the fund is divided up evenly among all of the residents, adults and children, of the state. Each person gets between $1,000 and $3,000, depending on the fund's earnings in the past few years. But the average amount is about $1,400. This means that in most years, a family of four receives a check for a little less than $6,000 in October. A 2016 report from the University of Alaska's Institute of Social and Economic Research estimates that the dividend lifts 15,000 to 25,000 people above the poverty line, reducing the state's poverty rate by 25% while providing additional economic security to middle-class families. To be clear, $100 a month is far from the guaranteed income that most idealists and philosophers imagine. But it is an income floor, and the money comes like clockwork. The Economic Security Project, the group Natalie Dorian and I started, commissioned empirical research to get hard numbers on what people did with the money and how they felt about it. We also talked with ordinary Alaskans in public forums, private one-on-one conversations, and anonymous focus groups. I heard many stories about how people felt about the dividend, and at first, I was disappointed that Alaskans weren't saying that it was transformative and life-changing. They clearly cared about receiving the money. Quantitative polling showed that more than 80% believed it was important to preserve the dividend and that the money was generally used well. But no one dressed the fund up in grand ideals. The phrase Alaskans did repeat was, "It helps me make ends meet." The dividend check reliably helps poor and middle-class families alike put away an extra month's worth of rent, pay down credit card debt, or buy holiday gifts. The words freedom and dignity didn't come up once. The dividend check did a simple and important thing. It helped them pay the bills. As our work expanded, and we had more conversations across America, we found again and again that the way most people think about money, work, and the challenge of making ends meet has little in common with the vocabulary of philosophers arguing for a basic income. People from every income and educational level, with all kinds of political beliefs and backgrounds, struggled to make sense of why anyone would support something like a basic income. The idea of money provided from nowhere and with no strings attached seemed nonsensical. Money always comes from somewhere. Work, a gift, a loan, social security, an inheritance. Philosophers might think about money on a theoretical plane as an object of empowerment. But money only makes sense in practice in a concrete context of where it comes from and how it's used. A dollar found on the street is different than a dollar loaned from a family member, and that dollar is still different than one earned through work. One working-class woman in Detroit put it plainly, "I just don't understand where this money is coming from and why I would be getting it." Talking about money as an abstraction is something that seems to come from a place of privilege. Looking back on my own childhood, we never talked about the money we had as freeing or as a source of dignity. Of course, the middle-class salaries my parents made provided us with stability and a measure of autonomy. But the lived experience was much more prosaic. Money matters involved long, tedious Sunday afternoons, watching my parents peck away at the calculator with bills spread out across the dining room table. It was the ledger of the checkbook that my mom taught me how to balance and forced me to use for my own accounting when I was 10 years old. It was the $200 my parents allowed themselves to pull out of the bank each week for groceries, gas, and the occasional meal out. It was the coupons my mom clipped and saved in a pouch in her purse for our Friday afternoon grocery store trips. Coupons, checkbooks, ATMs, and calculators were our day-to-day experience of money. But perhaps the most welcome kind of money was the tax rebate check my parents occasionally got from Uncle Sam. One thing that everyone on the left and right loves is a rebate check, in the mail from the government. I still remember the $600 I got in 2008 from George Bush's attempt to stabilize the economy before the recession. The program was too little and too late to prevent the ensuing collapse, but the check was memorable. It arrived in a nondescript envelope, but was a rainbow of colors and embossed with holograms, just like the ones my grandparents got from Social Security. Similar checks come to many American households each year in the form of tax refunds. But few people know that a lot of the money in rebate checks is paid for by an anti-poverty program called the Earned Income Tax Credit, or the EITC. America almost established a guaranteed income 50 years ago, but created the EITC instead. It's a complicated-sounding benefit and an awkward acronym, but boring methods can sometimes accomplish big-picture ideals. The EITC is the framework we should use to make good on the promise of a guaranteed income for all working Americans. Everybody likes a tax credit. When I wasn't working on Facebook in college, I majored in history and literature. I was a kid who loved to speculate about things like Napoleon's thoughts after Waterloo, or how James Baldwin felt when the publisher of Giovanni's Room told him to burn the manuscript. History wasn't just interesting to me. I came to understand that a better grasp of it could help us navigate the world we live in today. Lessons from the last American guaranteed income debate might inspire a new generation of activists and teach us how to most effectively wage the fight ahead. As Mark Twain allegedly said, history doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes. We got very close to creating an income floor in the United States once before. A little over 50 years ago, a Republican president proposed a guaranteed income, and the bill passed the House of Representatives. It failed in the Senate, but the framework for today's guaranteed income, the Earned Income Tax Credit, emerged from the ashes. The 1960s chapter of the guaranteed income story doesn't start with the flower power of organized hippies, but with a set of conservative policymakers led by the Nobel Prize-winning economist Milton Friedman. Like many things in history, before him, there was a woman who hatched the original idea who doesn't always get her due. In the 1940s in Britain, Lady Juliette Rees-Williams developed the idea of the negative income tax, which became the most popular design for how to create a guaranteed income for most of the 20th century. She proposed a cash allowance delivered through the tax system. The more money a person makes, the higher the income tax they pay. So too, she argued, should a cash allowance increase the further below the poverty line a person falls. If the poverty line was set at 500 pounds, for example, and the negative tax rate was 50%, then a person who earned zero income would receive 50% of the poverty threshold, a guaranteed income of 250 pounds. If the person earned 200 pounds, then he would receive half of the difference between his wages and the poverty threshold, or 150 pounds, for a total income of 350 pounds. Once his wages passed the poverty line, he'd begin paying taxes. If you're confused, you're not alone. Most policymakers found the idea elegant in theory, but woefully difficult to understand. But for all its complexity, they loved that it would ensure that it paid to work. Recipients would always make more money from paid employment and benefits combined than they could from benefits alone. The idea hopped the Atlantic, and American conservative economist Milton Friedman became a devoted advocate of it. Many conservatives of the time joined him in the belief that the negative income tax would be more efficient at helping people in poverty than the same amount of money invested in social services. The advantages of this arrangement are clear Friedman wrote in his landmark book, Capitalism and Freedom, in 1962. It is directed specifically at the problem of poverty, and it gives help in the form most useful to the individual, namely, cash. It is general and could be substituted for the host of special measures now in effect. Friedman continued to support the idea for the rest of his life. In the years after he wrote those words, the idea gained steam on the left as well. The focus of the civil rights movement in the late 1960s turned to economic justice, and the idea of a guaranteed income played a major role. In the final 2 years of his life, Martin Luther King Jr. traveled the country demanding that the government create programs to make up for decades of racial and economic injustice. King argued forcefully that all Americans should have a guaranteed income to provide them with economic stability. In 1967, he launched the Poor People's Campaign, which included a call for a guaranteed income. He planned what would perhaps have been his largest march ever on Washington for April of 1968, the month he was shot and killed. 3 days before he died, King delivered the Sunday sermon at the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. He called for the United States to jettison its massive investment in war and to shift the country's spending to a suite of social services to shore up the income security of all Americans. "There is nothing new about poverty," he declared. "What is new is that we now have the techniques and the resources to get rid of poverty. The real question is whether we have the will." Unlike conservative economists who envisioned cashing in existing programs for a guaranteed income, King believed that a guaranteed income pegged to median wages and GDP growth would work best alongside an expanded set of social services. The combination of the two could abolish poverty in America for good. He foresaw a black-white coalition of laborers who would come together to overcome inevitable opposition from the wealthy and powerful. And in the year before he was felled by an assassin's bullet, he laid the groundwork for the fight. Meanwhile, mainstream politicians and academics were studying the idea and contributing to a robust national policy debate about how it might work. In 1967, at a conference at Arden House, an estate just outside of New York City, economists and policymakers came together to discuss the relative merits of major social reform policies and left with a consensus to prioritize a guaranteed income over other similarly big ideas like a universal child allowance. President Lyndon Johnson's Office of Economic Opportunity decided to pilot the idea in a controlled test in New Jersey, which began in August 1968. Other sites subsequently opened in Iowa, North Carolina, Seattle, Denver, and Gary, Indiana. Over the course of the following decade, more than 10,000 American families received guaranteed incomes as participants in the studies. It was a heady time in American politics when it was possible, even fashionable, to think big on both sides of the aisle. In the years leading up to 1968, we had sent men into space for the first time, made enormous civil rights gains, and created Medicare. Eugene McCarthy, a Democratic candidate for president, embraced the idea of a guaranteed income in the presidential race in 1968. At the same time, in the center and on the right, concern grew that the nation's welfare rolls were expanding too rapidly, and that the system badly needed simplification and reform. After Richard Nixon's victory in that election, his administration shocked the left and right alike when it entrusted a bipartisan group of policymakers to develop a welfare reform plan that put a guaranteed income at its center. Nixon's Family Assistance Plan proposed using a negative income tax to provide an income floor of $1,600 a year for a family of four, or around $11,000 in today's dollars. The Social Security Administration was slated to distribute the funds just as it did pension checks. Following Reese Williams' initial idea, Nixon's version of a guaranteed income was designed to encourage work. It phased out gradually as the incomes of families receiving it increased. In August 1969, Nixon gave a nationally televised address, his version of a Roosevelt fireside chat, to explain his vision for welfare reform, including the guaranteed income. The wonder of the American character is that so many have the spark and the drive to fight their way up, he said. But for millions of others, the burdens of poverty in early life snuff out that spark. What I am proposing, he continued, is that the federal government build a foundation under the income of every American family with dependent children that cannot care for itself and wherever in America that family may live. Even though response to the speech was overwhelmingly positive, little of it was grounded in enthusiasm for a guaranteed income. The support was almost exclusively focused on welfare reform, not the promise of providing cash assistance through the negative income tax. The story of what happened next would have outsized consequences for generations to come. Though support for the guaranteed income plan itself was thin, it passed the House of Representatives after some debate and with bipartisan support. Once it arrived in the Senate, however, the debate grew much more fraught. Republicans grew concerned about whether the work requirements would be stringent enough and whether the bill would deliver on its promise to reduce the size of government. Democrats, in turn, split over the size of the benefit. Many non-Southern liberals wanted it to be 2 or 3 times larger, and over how to ensure no family would end up worse off under the new bill. Much of the conversation was caught up in a debate about whether people would keep working if they had an income floor. The Johnson administration's pilot programs to answer this question had begun only a few years before and had yet to produce clear, conclusive evidence. As we'll see, they later showed that people did, in fact, keep working. Lacking any clear way to resolve the competing interests, the bill failed in the Finance Committee in 1971. According to the architect of the plan, future New York Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, the program was both too much and too little, too radical, too reactionary, too comprehensive, not comprehensive enough. And perhaps most importantly, it was far too complex. Even after years of debate in the House and Senate, Moynihan believed that very few legislators, the people actually voting on the measure, had any idea how much one of their constituents would receive. After the dust settled, Moynihan predicted that future proposals would use a flat grant system, as close to the poverty level as possible, instead of a negative income tax. George McGovern proposed this in 1972 in his unsuccessful bid for the presidency. A more modest, flat benefit, clearly and simply tied to work, would have made it much more likely for the original proposal to pass. But the failure of the family assistance plan was not absolute. In 1974, Nixon signed a bill creating a guaranteed income for the elderly and disabled that still exists today, Supplementary Security Income. Nearly 9 million disabled Americans and indigent seniors currently get a guaranteed income of $735 per month from the federal government. But an even more important policy emerged from the ashes of the guaranteed income debate, the EITC, that passed Congress just a few years later. I was initially skeptical that such a wonky acronym could channel the guaranteed income's romantic values of freedom and dignity for all. The EITC sounds boring, technical, and incremental. In fact, its anodyne brand was key to its initial passage and later expansion. Ironically, the author of the program, Democratic Senator Russell Long, had helped torpedo Nixon's guaranteed income plan. Long was a deep populist who made a career fighting the concentration of power and wealth in the tradition of his father, Huey Long, the populist Louisiana governor who ran the state with near dictatorial power until his assassination. Russell Long used less blustering tactics and focused on reshaping the tax code in his role as the chair of the Senate Finance Committee. He exercised enormous power for decades in Washington, and the Wall Street Journal once called him the fourth branch of government. While Long agreed that a more active government was needed to help the poor, he took issue with the work requirements in Nixon's original proposal. That plan required people to register and prove they were looking for a job. Long preferred to create a government boost to private sector wages, creating a natural incentive to work, rather than a new bureaucracy to enforce work. In 1972, Long proposed that the government provide a cash supplement of 10% of the first $4,000 of the annual earned income of poor families, a wage match that recipients would get once a year. The measure failed, and he reintroduced similar bills in the next 2 years. In 1975, he slipped the idea into a much larger tax bill, and despite its sizable cost of about $8 billion in today's dollars, President Gerald Ford signed it into law in March 1975. Once an affordable framework was established and legislators had a sense of its effects, it became much easier to expand upon it. Every president since Ford, Democrat and Republican alike, has signed a bill to significantly increase the benefit. Legislators love this program. Most people don't know it, but the EITC and its cousin, the Child Tax Credit, are the most powerful tools to combat poverty that we have today. These unglorified tax credits already lift as many people out of poverty as food stamps, rent subsidies, and unemployment insurance combined. The EITC's effectiveness and popularity make it the perfect framework to use to build a modern guaranteed income. Currently, the EITC provides $70 billion in cash with no strings attached to 26 million working families and individuals. Recipients get as little as $500 or as much as $6,000 a year as part of their tax rebate checks from the Internal Revenue Service. The calculations to determine the amount a person receives are woefully complex and depend on multiple factors. If you work, how much you earn, how old you are, how many children you have, and what state you live in. Only the rare family whose income is very stable has a sense of what they will receive year to year. But for all its mathematical complexity, the mechanics of the EITC are very simple. A check arrives once a year, and the recipient can use it however he or she likes. The EITC's fan club is as broad and politically diverse as it is because we now actually know a lot about what happens when we provide people with cash. Dozens of studies document its positive effects. It lifts 10 million people out of poverty each year, transforming their lives. Kids whose families receive the earned income or child tax credit are significantly more likely to stay in school longer, and they perform better on standardized tests. Economist Raj Chetty and his colleagues have found that for every $1,000 a family receives in tax credits, students' test scores improve by 6%. Kids are more likely to finish high school and to enroll in college, and when they get there, they're more likely to stay there. In families with incomes boosted by $250 per month, children under 5 go on to earn 17% more each year than kids from families with no boost. For every 10% increase in the EITC, infant mortality rates decrease significantly. The number of babies born with low birth weights, a sign of inadequate nutrition, also decreases meaningfully. There's no evidence that cash benefits cause people to work less. In fact, some studies suggest that they work more. Women make more money in the years after getting a boost in their EITC than women in control groups who do not receive the boost. The EITC seems to slightly reduce the rates of smoking and drinking, presumably because of decreased stress levels. Evidence of the impact of the EITC is only one part of a large research base documenting the transformative impact of regular cash payments. The most robust data, not from the EITC, comes from the guaranteed income experiments